Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Radiation fears are rising. Government shutdown potentially happening in Portugal. Civil unrest in the Middle East is spreading, but markets are calm and the VIX drops the most in 7 days since 2008. That and much more on this episode, number 205 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and how are you? We are finishing up the month of March, almost into April already, if you can believe that. And there is lots to talk about. And one of the things that is on most people's minds is what, if any, effect will the radiation from the nuclear reactors in Japan have on not only me, but my investments and the food around the world? And I have no idea. I mean, I really don't know much about radiation. I don't know who does, right? We just know radiation is bad. So what I thought we would do is go out and get an expert. I said, you know what? I got to get to the bottom of this. I need to understand more about this. And at the same time, probably a lot of people that are listening and that tune in every week want to hear about it too. So you know what? We got a professor from the University of Michigan's Nuclear Engineering Department. Dr. or Professor Gary Wise is going to be with us here today. And our old friend, not so old, but a friend for a long time, John Markman is going to be here too. Great guy to get the ins and outs of the markets and understand the psychology and some of the basic tenets of how to invest. So we're going to talk with him and Professor Waz in a little bit. And I just want to start out with a couple of things here today. I think that we talked about this, but I'm going to let you know one last time, or maybe twice more. If you could help out, and I would really appreciate it, I have mentioned that the Jason Taylor Foundation Reading Room, a really important thing for me, and my birthday was last week, and I asked everybody if you can to provide a little bit of a, if you wanted to, if you were thinking about it, if you like me, if you don't like me, if you like the show, whatever, could you give a little something to this charity? It would mean a lot to me. Just go over to the Disciplined Investor website and just click on the donate button and provide a little bit of money to help out underprivileged kids throughout Miami and around the area in South Florida that can actually use a place to go after school, learn a little bit more about some other topics aside from the street, play some ball, and also learn some reading at the same time. A great charity. I encourage you to look it up. The Jason Taylor Foundation. Jason's a great guy, too. Very charitable. So far, we've raised a lot of money. But we need your help. Seriously, just a little bit, whether it's $25 or $50, $100, I'll send you a copy of my book, one of my books signed. I'll sign it personally to you, and I'd really appreciate that. But let's get into this whole topic that I think is on everybody's mind of, wow, there's so much stuff going on out there that seems really bad. I mean, now we're seeing Syria have all sorts of problems on top of the situation in Libya, on top of the situation where we had the bombing in Israel now, and the continuation and the spreading of the unrest, and who knows where it goes next, is seemingly not causing any problems for anybody. And when we tie that to the price of oil going up over 105, hitting I think 106, close to 107 last week, it didn't seem like anybody was bothered, where just a few weeks prior, everybody was really concerned about the effects of that. But you know what? It's been downplayed. It's been really downplayed. Well, the economists say, you know, a prolonged period really won't hurt the economy. This is what they always say, right? Nothing hurts the economy. Nothing. Because earnings are all that matters. But hello, fellas. Earnings are based on spending. And when you have consumer confidence rolling over as hard as it did on Friday, you have to wonder if, you know, spending is going to keep up in the face of higher oil prices. Now, add to that, there's this whole issue of radiation fears. And, of course, the Japanese market doesn't seem to be the economy is not going to hurt the world economy, as most people say, which you got to wonder how that is, too. And then Portugal, basically the prime minister stepping down and saying, you know what, we're if you're not going to accept these reasonable or even these strong requirements on the budget and tax increases, I just can't be a part of this anymore. And then paving the way nicely for a $100 billion potential bailout by the European Union. And the euro doesn't even seem phased. And then on top of that, the Canadian government is basically toppled and going to be disbanded because of no confidence vote. And then finally, you have to look at the concerns that we're all having about the growing and you know debt issue in the United States. And you just wonder, why aren't markets really that concerned? I mean, sure, they sold off for a week and a half, and it was a 4 or 5% dip, and then they just came kind of, you know, quickly back in a few days. But it was a low volume. That's got to be a concern. One of the reasons is that we have a market right now, and we have an environment right now that is one of those environments that a lot of people are real happy about. They say, you know what? If bad news can't take down a market, then you're really in a strong bull market rally, a very strong market that can really absorb all this. But on the other hand, there's a point when you have bad news and then you have bad news, right? You have bad news that can be absorbed by the market because the understanding is that on the other side, well, it's temporary and these are things that can be overcome easily. Then there's a market that can take bad news and ignore it. Don't even look at it. Just say, you know what? It doesn't exist. The Japanese market fell by 16%. Just within the days after the earthquake. Immediately, major investors poured in an unprecedented amount of money into Japan without knowing what the effect will be, without an understanding of the total damage, without understanding the economic impact, without understanding anything more than the Japanese market was down. Now, you may say, Andrew, well, things always have a way of working out. Well, yes and no. I mean, is it going to work out for TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric company, who for years has ignored all sorts of warning signs and essentially lied to the public? I don't know. You're going to get bailed out just like Portugal is going to get bailed out. Is that why the European area is happy? Because the effectiveness of the prime minister resigning means that there won't be further cuts in spending and there won't be any further increases in taxes. And it's a free ride again by the Eurozone, which might I say that Germany is awfully pissed off about. Spain was downgraded last week two notches. Portugal double downgrade by two different major firms. The banks across Spain were downgraded. Yet, it was a great week for European stocks. On news of Oracle? What in the world does that have to do with anything? Technology spending was up for Oracle. There's other companies that we can't say the same for. But yet, everybody's happy because Oracle came out with some good news. Research in Motion came out with some awful news. Okay, we could write that one off because we realized that the Android phones and the Apple iPhones and the iPads and all these other things are taking the lead, and they don't have any great products right now that can really compete, and their iPad killer is really more like an iPad, you know, clone that is probably not going to get a lot of sales. So why in the world, with the reality, by the way, that we knew this going into earnings, was anybody bidding up the stock? Commentary from some investment guru said, you know, boy, RIM is universally hated. That may be a really good reason to get into the stock. Wow. What a horrible, horrible way to invest. Because something is hated, I should invest in it. This is the kind of advice you're getting from TV gurus, right? This is the kind of advice that you're getting when people, you know, that you listen to in major media say, oh, you have to buy on the dip. Yes, there's some benefit to buying on the dip if it's a dip for a reason. Maybe it's an overblown situation. Who knows? But that as a basic tenet of investing is what got people smacked in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s during the downtrends. I mean, smacked. So just consider all the things that are going on right now. Now, with that, you have to consider also that because of this basic high level of ignoring any bad news, the VIX, the volatility index, actually took a nosedive down about 40% from the high when all this was coming together. In 7 days, dropped about 40% down to almost 16 from about 31. Finished up about 17 and change, close to 18 on Friday. Now, wow. Whenever I see the VIX make some substantial moves in one direction or the other, you have to wonder, what is the euphoria or the panic? Is it really right? Is it something that's going to continue? One of the things I mentioned a couple of weeks ago was that you could actually pick up options or maybe even an ETF on the VIX. One thing that we do for our clients every once in a while, and especially when we see some of this volatility come in, it's been nice, where you see the movement from high to low. In other words, not just an uptrend, not just a downtrend, but a move between both, right? A quick up, quick down, quick up to quick down. It you know, 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, maybe even 10 days at a time in one direction. Because those switches back and forth are what give some serious gusto to an option on the VIX. Because you get an immediate drop when people are selling out and panicking out, and then you get an immediate move up when they're moving in, into the VIX, that is, or opposite for the markets. So what we did was we've moved back and forth a few times recently, and we just actually picked up close to the bottom on Friday another option. We bought the April 20s on the VIX for our clients, and I actually have it for our clients, a hard odds company, and own it as well for across the board. So for certain strategies, I should say, and I think that what's interesting about this is that because it dropped off, still kind of a little bit expensive. It was about 165 or 170 or so, 170 I think it was, plus or minus when we picked it up originally. And when you look at the moves of what happened, where it dropped about, that dropped about 50% as well over that period of time. If you just move into the money over the next couple of weeks, there's only about 4 weeks left on this option. But if you move into the money very quickly, and that can happen with any move down of this market, a couple of days is going to move the VIX probably up to about 21, 22 again. Boy, that gets in the money real quick. Plus, you get that time value in there, and that could be very nicely rewarded. Now, be careful. If you don't know anything about options, I really wouldn't recommend this. But utilizing VIX calls and puts a month or so out, usually, if there is volatility and moving it back and forth to protect your portfolio or look for extra profits, is a wonderful way to really enhance portfolios or to hedge a bit, I should say. Because the volatility is really what the problem is, really not the movement of the stocks, because the movement of the stocks, if you move in and out, can really whipsaw you a little bit. We all know about that. And we know about that. Right now, we're only about, I think, 25% net long, a lot of cash and some shorts in the portfolio. We picked up a short of Freeport MacMoran on the falling copper story and the housing story clearly in the United States, and the construction demand that's falling off around the world. So we start to pare back on the stocks. We picked up some shorts. We sold some of the shorts, and we picked up the VIX on the put side. Make sure I said that right. We did buy the put recently, and then we bought the call. So we had the put, and then we went into the call. So we're looking for volatility to increase again. And we also are just holding on to core positions and waiting for a volume tell, if you will. If we see some reasonable amounts of upside on volume, because recently it's really been a story about distribution. Very big distribution on very big volume. Nice moves up on extremely, extremely low volume. As a matter of fact, I think on Wednesday or Thursday was the worst volume, the least volume of 2011 in the market, indicating absolute complacency and lack of interest by investors. So that's why markets could see volatility, because any kind of move in any direction is going to gather steam when you don't have a lot of people selling and a lot of people buying, just kind of the inside work being done. I would mention this and ask you for your consideration, and then we're going to get into some discussions with our guests. But consider this, that really there's the potential for a lot of distribution going on, but you know, the guys distributing are not stupid. The hedge funds, the mutual funds, the institutions, they'll distribute for a few days and let it pop up. They'll distribute for a few days and let it pop out up. Unless there's something that's imminent, that's really going to get bad fast and stay bad, at least in the opinion of the public, they're not going to show their hand. They're not going to just blow it out if they want to get out in the next 2-3 months immediately. What they're going to do is they're going to sell, let it rise up a little bit so they don't damage the price permanently of a position, maybe let it get to the 50-day and then hold off, sell into it again, hold off, And watch the trail over the next couple of weeks and see if the tail of the tape says that you see big distribution days and little rides up. Big distribution days, little rides up. Because if you think about it, you work the futures on the way up. If you're the big boys, you take your futures out and then you sell your stocks underneath it and you kind of bleed it out that way, this way not disrupting the total market. It's kind of a smart way to do it. Just think about that and watch the tape. So, you know, one of the things we wanted to do here was to find out what is going on in Japan. Lots of talk going on about this radiation issue and exposure and fuel rods. So I thought we'd go to one of the best that we could find, and that is Professor Gary Waz, a professor of nuclear engineering and radiological sciences at the University of Michigan. Hello, sir.
Good day.
Hey, you've been busy?
A little bit.
That's an understatement, right? So let me ask you a couple of things. I mean, you know, you did some great presentation back on the 18th, and you went over the dose ratios and all this stuff. I know nothing about this, okay? The audience knows nothing about this. You know, and I know there's a lot of panic issues and all that, but in layman's terms, the amount of radiation that is coming out of this, what does it mean?
You know, it's very difficult at this point in this emergency at these reactors to really have a good understanding of how much radiation is being emitted, and if so, where and when.
Mm-hmm.
There are two sources that the radiation is coming from, and each of these two sources is in each of the reactor buildings. One potential source is the reactor itself. These reactors, we understand, are still in relatively good shape. The cores are contained in the pressure vessels, and that's contained in a very thick concrete containment. But early on in the accident, they were having problems with steam building up in the pressure vessels and had to release some of that steam, and that carried some radiation with it. So there were these puffs that were being emitted from the reactor. You can't see them, but that's essentially what they are.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem are the spent fuel storage pools, which are the pools that hold the used fuel. And you've seen periodically on TV, it looks like there is a fire in one of these buildings, normally 3 and 4, and that's usually followed by a spike in the measured radiation in the environment, probably because the fuel rods got uncovered, and there's some fuel damage to the fuel due to the high temperatures, and that released radiation.
So there's a lot of different things that are going on, is what your point is. There's a lot of potential areas. But the fuel rods seem to be, there's a lot more of those in that number 3 reactor, right? That's where they stored them.
You mean in the spent fuel pool?
Yeah.
Actually, the most rods in the spent fuel pool is in number 4.
Okay, so again, for us lay people, you know, this radiation, this reactor. My understanding is because of the way they've gone about trying to cool this, because they have to cool this down and they don't want the quote-unquote meltdown, which I'm going to ask you about in a second, is they poured all this water on it, right? So
correct.
These things can't be used again. These things are toast.
That's right. Water is going on. It is going on the spent fuel or into the spent fuel storage pool, and it's just what it sounds like. It's a pool. It's a huge pool, about almost the same volume of water as an Olympic-sized swimming pool, a little bit less, but a different shape, much deeper and not as long and wide. And there, they're just adding water to keep those old rods underwater. They're also using water to cool the core of the reactor. That water is being injected into the containment to keep that cool as well.
Right.
So, but because there's seawater in both cases, once you put seawater into the core of a reactor, it's not going to be usable again.
So, okay. So now, and we get into the discussion about what are they going to do for electricity. I mean, I thought the funniest thing, which is not funny, it's sad. You know, they're going to bring some. First of all, you don't have to say anything here. I find that the Japanese authorities involved in this, or whoever is involved in releasing the information on this, has been rather, let's say, difficult to interpret all the details of what they're saying. You know, they talk about how they brought the power to the cooling devices to restart the cooling at the various reactors, and
right.
They need to have power. And they brought this cable, which you can only imagine is a gigantic extension cord. And the thing is, you know, they don't talk about, you know, that whether or not the coolers that they are actually even working to the level they are, they just said the lights are on. I just find it to be, you know, what is the real story here? Does anybody even know?
You know, I think probably the answer is no, they don't know.
Yeah.
We're all frustrated by the lack of information, clearly. We all want to know exactly what's going on. But, you know, I think you do have to remember there, at least until recently, unless the situation's changed, there are 50 people running a site that requires closer to 1,500.
Mm.
And they're doing it with flashlights in radiation suits, and they're working in the dark. So if I was one of those 50 people, you know, giving timely, accurate, and complete updates on what I'm doing is not my high priority.
Yeah.
It's managing a situation.
So I
think you have to be, you know, I think you have to be pragmatic and realize that that's a big, big part of why you're not hearing so much.
Yeah.
More will come out in the days, believe me. We will hear much more as the story unfolds, but that's going to take weeks and months.
So right now, I mean, to get to the heart of this matter, and to talk about what people seem to be either ignoring or upset about, depending on where you are and what your perspective is on this, this whole presentation that you put together talks about, it seems to me that what you're saying here is that at this point, or at least through the 18th, there wasn't enough radiation release to be extremely concerned about unless there was an excessive amount of time and duration where a person would be in close proximity to. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what presentation you're referring to, but I think that statement's probably a pretty good one. As of the 18th, we know how much radiation is being emitted only by the measurements that are made, either at the gate or further away from the plant. And there are various independent sources that you can consult, like the IAEA has a good website for looking this up. So that's how we're getting our information. And up until that point, radiation levels were elevated, but not to a point where it was looking like it was going to be a big problem.
Are you concerned right now that the level of radiation, or at least the component of radiation in some form of iodine or whatever it may be, has reached the tap water in Tokyo? It's been in spinach, it's been in cows, you know, and now in the seawater. Are we at a point of being concerned, or where do we ever get concerned?
Well, I think it's certainly something to worry about. And think about, you know, one of the issues is that they're to realize is that when radiation is released, it doesn't show up immediately.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be carried by the winds, and winds and rain and dispersion all affect where it comes down and how much of it comes down. So one of the things that you're seeing is not a result of yesterday or an hour ago, but perhaps a result of, what's happened several days ago, but it's just now showing up in the environment.
Right.
You know, I am radiation effects on people, and is not my area of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
But the government of Japan does have safety limits for activity levels of certain nuclides in the environment, and
Right. Certainly
if those measured amounts are getting above those levels, that certainly is some cause for concern. I assume they wouldn't have set those levels unless there was a reason for doing so.
Yeah.
It's also been a bit confusing the way it's been reported in the media as well, which is that levels of iodine or cesium and milk and spinach have exceeded certain levels by X amount, whatever that is. But then you'll read in the next paragraph that the government doesn't think that that's of immediate danger. And that's very confusing, too, and the reason is because the danger level of how much contamination can be on something is set by assuming that it's consumed continually for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
So short periods of time of consumption, they're probably right, it's not a danger. But I guarantee you, everybody's confused out of their mind.
Yeah, not only that. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, if the government sound the alarm, people would freak out, and they don't want that. They'd rather, you know, you start mass hysteria and stampedes, and you know, the government would I think rather. This is my opinion since this deal started, this whole thing happened. They would rather wait to the last minute to really release all the information that may be bad, in the hopes that they can actually get things, cleaned up in the meantime. But that's another here or there. Last question for you, sir.
Sure.
I think this may be a little bit more up your alley. First of all, is it aggravating you that they have been, the political winds are now blowing, along with the radiation winds, that have now said, like in Germany, that they're going to shut down 7 of their old reactors, and these guys are going to shut down their nuclear power plans. And already in the U.S., I mean, everybody's all up in arms. You know, to stir these senators and governors and congressmen up is pretty easy, you know, just to kind of get them on one side or the other or something. And they're all kind of saying, well, nuclear energy is no good now. I mean, is this aggravating you?
Well, sure it is. And I guess it tells you who's playing politics as well.
Right, exactly.
But sure. And, you know, I guess if somebody were to ask me this question, my response is that I really hope that both governments around the world and industry take the time to systematically and methodically assess this situation. Don't jump to conclusions. Don't make knee-jerk reactions and decisions that they may regret later on. You know, this you need to consider risks and reward for everything.
Right.
And you need to also incorporate everything you learn. We're going to learn, or nuclear energy is going to learn a lot from this incident. And if the decision is made to continue to run plants, that new knowledge is going to be fed back into operations, designs, backfitting, retrofitting, whatever.
Right.
You can bet. The NRC is very diligent about that. But also, you never make decisions in the heat of battle either, like
right.
this.
Yeah, I hear you. Can I give you a, since you're going to probably be consulted on this and all that, and you're going to teach, can I give a recommendation that may be worthwhile?
Please.
Okay. Here, hope you're sitting down for this one, because this is
okay.
really going to, this is going to make your career. And I'm not going to take credit, okay? Here's what it is.
Okay.
Do not build nuclear reactors in areas that have high earthquake probabilities, near areas that are close to the shore that could have tsunamis that may plow the thing under. Just a thought.
Yes. Well, you know, if we knew that a tsunami and an earthquake of those magnitudes would converge on that point in one day, I bet you they wouldn't.
No, I agree. But if you look at a map and look where the earthquakes are prone to be, it is smack in the middle of it. And they could have
right.
moved the thing a little bit more, maybe inshore or something of that nature. And I think other thing that we may learn is that it may make sense, even though it may cost a lot, in the future to upgrade rather than just let something, be as efficient as possible for the money-making profitability of the company itself. And my understanding is that these that were built in the 70s have much different levels of containment capability than the ones that are being designed today.
The containments are different. The safety systems are different. A lot of things are different. But it's very important to realize, at least in the U.S., the NRC is absolutely diligent about holding all plants to the same standard for that locale. That is, just because you've got a 30-year-old plant doesn't mean you get a free pass when they decide the safety level should be above where you're at. You retrofit.
Right,
and bring it up to standard, or you can't operate, and that's all. And that's been one of the reasons for the outstanding safety record in this country.
Yeah, even though we haven't built anything since the 70s. So, do you still you agree that nuclear is probably one of the cleanest and much and the most economical of all the potential fuels, if you will, for heating and other types of options that we have right now to get off of fossil fuels?
Yeah, well, certainly the cleanest.
Yeah.
Very, very clean, and. Economical, we've learned to run, as an industry, they have learned to run these plants very economically. And it took a generation to learn how to do that.
Right.
But they're now very, very cheap to operate. They are still very expensive to build, and that's always been a barrier to bringing a lot of plants online.
Right.
But
I hear you. Well, Professor Waz from the University of Michigan, Michigan Engineering, and a great place up there in Ann Arbor, which I do enjoy visiting, since my wife is an alumni of Michigan. Go Blue! I appreciate you being here and trying to clear the air. Maybe that's not the right thing to say, but
that's my pleasure.
Yeah, okay.
I appreciate the opportunity.
All right, be well. Bye bye.
Goodbye.
All right, you know, we just had this discussion about nuclear situations and reactors and radiation and all that, and it was more of the technical side of things. I thought it'd be great to talk with John Markman, a good friend of mine for many, many, a few years. And he writes the Strategic Advantage newsletter, which is a must-have if you're looking for great ideas and different types of portfolio management. And he also writes for Market Watch. Brilliant guy. He's actually helped me with bringing, he's the guy that introduced me to Das and Terry Bedford. So, John, how are you? How's it going? Been a while.
Doing great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. So, you and I were joking around before we got on this discussion just now, and I said, it looks like, with all the things going on with the Syrian problem and Israel and Portugal collapsing or whatever's going on there, Libya continuing to escalate, oil over 106, and on durable goods looking like they were just terrible, terrible durable goods number. The only thing that seems to possibly be able to derail this, the idea that anybody should be just purely spending all their money putting in stocks, is maybe like an alien invasion or something, right?
Yeah, or maybe, people should worry about the Federal Reserve waking up one morning and deciding that it's not going to debase our currency anymore. How about that?
Well, that would be great if that would actually seem to be a reality, but it started with Greenspan, and it's continuing with Bernanke. Although, recently they said they're going to start doing some reverse repurchase agreements. Doesn't that give a hint that they're going to start to slow down the massive amounts of money that will be in the markets?
Listen, the first thing you need to know about Bernanke, as well as Obama, is that their main job is to stay in office.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to stay in office, they need to keep the economy as strong as possible, at least through 2011 and 2012. So if you just keep that in mind, everything else becomes a little bit more clear. They have a mission. They have a mission to, the stated mission is to improve the unemployment rate.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the economy rising. At least at a 2.5 to 3% clip over the next 2 years. And in order to do that, they need to have. They realize that the economy all by itself is still faltering. It's still not on sure footing. And as we see, saw today in the durable goods numbers. From a fiscal point of view. The government is pretty much out of options. The states and county governments are in aggregate out of money, can't do any projects of their own. And the federal government, with the Tea Party and the Republicans kind of blocking new spending, is not going to launch a new fiscal spending program this year, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're really down to is tax policy, which was set in motion last year. That's good. And monetary policy. And, there's no break on monetary policy. The Congress theoretically has oversight over the Fed, but, no one really exercises that, and they never are going to.
Right.
So that leaves Bernanke and the Fed pretty much the major option that the government has in order to keep the economy pumping through this year and next year. And I think that, they feel like that is their mission, and they are not going to stray from their mission. And
right.
If it takes QE 2, 3, 4, and 5, that's what they're going to do. And and everyone's, you mentioned the reverse repo agreements, and that's possibly a kind of a sliver of a whisper of a hint that something may be different in the wind. But fundamentally, in every public interaction, Bernanke has given not even a nod, not even a wink to the idea that he's going to do anything but keep pumping money throughout the rest of this year.
So I think what's the most curious part of what's going on right now is that if left alone without the tinkering from the Fed, et cetera, you would have to say that, maybe the effects of Japan, maybe the effects of a oil prices over 106, 105, and such a short time that they actually spiked, could have an effect on the economy, but over and over again, you're finding that, for the most part, economists are saying that the Japanese situation will have very little, if any, effect on the global economy, and they're also saying that oil prices won't have an effect. Now, I find that hard to believe from just a purely mathematical equation, and in fact, Morgan Stanley this week came out with a note that said that global GDP will be dropped by about 0.5% in the next quarter or so, on a year-over-year basis, because of the Japanese situation. Do you believe that those two points, the Japanese circumstances happening and what's going on there, and oil prices?
Well, the concern about Japan is actually kind of amusing to me, because Japan I don't even think anybody mentioned Japan, like up until about a month ago. It was like not. It was like the forgotten third largest economy. You know, people. You know, you talked about Germany. Talked about Japan. I mean, talked about China. Talked about emerging markets. Talked about the United States. But I think if you ran a Google search of Japanese news over the previous 1 year to the earthquake, you'd find that nobody was talking about it. And now suddenly it's the most important thing in the world, to GDP growth.
Well, John, with respect, the news has been very, very slanted towards the good news part of the equation. Aside from incidents, aside from clashes, aside from things of that nature. And Japan had really nothing good to say. If you looked at their export numbers and you looked at their deficits and all that, it was really horrible. But it was, okay, what are you going to do about it? Let's talk about the good stuff. Let's talk about how great Germany is. Let's talk about how great...
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, Japan was a very neutral element in the world.
Right.
And so if you take away a neutral... if you take away a piece of a neutral element, I'm not sure that it really makes you a negative element.
Right. I'm with you on that, but it does seem like... There should be something. I mean, and then there's the other side of the equation that a lot of people are saying, hey, you know what? This is going to be an unbelievable opportunity to rebuild, whether it's the steel concrete companies, the companies like a Caterpillar or any of the companies that made you logistics. I mean, there's something to be said about that.
Yes and no. I mean, I've seen that argument before, but, Japan has been stimulating. This would have amount to a big stimulus program, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Japan's been stimulating for 2 decades.
Right.
So if it stimulates again, does that make it an improvement in the economy? I don't know. I kind of doubt it. Really fixing what wasn't broke with borrowed money is not a good formula for stronger GDP growth.
Well, going back to what you were saying a second ago, that obviously if you take away a negative from a negative, you get nothing. But with that same logic, if you keep doing what doesn't work, it's not going to work. It's probably not going to work if you keep doing it. Which is the continual spending and stimulus that Japan was doing.
Yeah, I mean, Japan is a special case. They're really the sixth man in the world, and they have been for 2 decades.
Do you think that the United States, though, that model of what happened to Japan with the property bubble bursting and the aging population and everything involved there, do you think that it is somewhat of a, maybe not a perfect model, but at least a model for what we could be turning out to be in the future?
You know, it's tempting to think that that's true because they had, they peaked with a property bubble and a credit bubble in 1989, and have been sliding ever since. On wave after wave of stimulus spending and attempted debasing of their currency, which hasn't really worked either. But it's really a much different country than the United States, and the biggest thing that the United States has going for it. It's something that a lot of the conservatives don't understand, and that is our immigration rate.
Mm-hmm.
We have fantastic capital formation, business formation. We have a very high and strong growth population growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
And as more people come into this country and more people are born, they need more stuff. They need more houses. They need more iPads. They need more phones. They need more
electronics. They need more iPads. They don't need more houses, and they don't need anything else, it seems. They need more iPads. Let's just get that right.
Yeah, but eventually, if they have enough iPads, they need some place to store them.
Yeah,
right.
So a storage facility. Okay, I got you there. Okay.
but the deal is, the real problem in Japan is, you hit it on the head, it's demographic. It's one of the few major countries with a negative growth rate.
Right.
It's like Russia. That's a huge problem. The older people have what they need, and now they're drawing down savings.
Yeah.
So it's, that's a very poor formula for growth. And if you look around the world at the countries that are growing the fastest, they are the ones with the fastest, growth rates.
Right.
So I think that, the fact that the United States does not have the demographic problems that Japan has is a huge, mm-hmm. huge factor that can't be ignored.
Now, I'd like to ask you, John Markman, put your kind of newsletter hat on, portfolio construction hat on, and maybe let's put your you'd have to put your contrarian hat on for this one. There's a lot of people that said that because the Japanese market took such a big hit a few days after this incident really started unfolding, upwards of 20%, that there was not only amazing buys and buying opportunities, but, buying the Japanese market as a whole would be good. Even though I think it was Barton Biggs who came on and said, He couldn't tell us why and quantify what would be the downside because they don't know. But he's buying anyway. Is that something that you would do?
I'm sorry, Andrew. Can you say that again?
The whole thing or just part of it?
Just.
You mean you start from the beginning of the interview or start from here?
No, that's just your last question.
The last question was Barton Biggs basically said that you have a market that went down 20%, and he could not tell us to quantify why or how or where this market was going and the risk that was involved. But yet, because it went down, he's buying. Is that something that you would do?
Well, I think that whenever you have a panic situation, it's probably a good idea to you can buy on a short-term basis. But if you have a lot of free finesse, that is, if you have subscribers or if you have clients, who are comfortable with taking that kind of risk.
Yeah, or if you have an unlimited pool of money where you can sock some of it away for a while and then convince people that you're in for the long haul. I mean, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the main argument on Japan is that the market is cheap.
Right.
And, it was cheap before this started, and it's even cheaper now. But in my view, absolute cheapness is not an excuse.
Yeah, I agree. I'm so sick of hearing that whole thing about cheap and everything's cheap. Everything's cheap. You know what's cheap for a reason, for goodness sakes? If everybody knew that and used that, then everybody would have bought it, and it wouldn't be cheap, for goodness sakes. I mean, come on. It's silly.
Right.
P.E. ratios. All right, let me ask you this.
Well, a lot of the Japanese, and there are not very many Japanese companies that are innovative. And that are as innovative as some of their U.S. and European counterparts,
mm-hmm.
and as well as have as strong sales overseas. You look at something like, look at their main electronics company, Sony.
Yeah.
It's just lost market share, hand over fist. Everything that they've tried to make in the last 10 years has been a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the largest computer company, NEC, has virtually no presence in the rest of the world. Their wireless company, NTT Docomo, is really just a local, Japanese company. The U.S. and Japanese banking companies have very little presence in the United States and in Europe. It's cheap because Japan has not innovated and not kept up with their European and U.S. counterparts.
I also think, John, that there's something to do with the fact that the yen has gone up in value by like 30% over the last several years. That prevents them from being very competitive and may, in fact, be forcing them to put out some inferior products. What do you think?
I think it's fair to say.
Yeah. So.
But, you could ask why is the yen that high? And I think that's a topic that's over my head.
Yeah, I hear you. That is a weird topic, actually. All right, let me ask you about the economic cycle. Could you at all, if we start from the trough on the left and peak to the right, and in the middle is recovery and something else of that nature, we know where the trough was. We have no question about that, right? I mean, that was easy. Where are we now?
I think we're in recovery mode. I think that left to its own devices, the U.S. economy is growing. The GDP is growing by about 2.5 to 3%. That's a little bit lower than the consensus view. But I think that stocks can actually do well in an environment where the U.S. GDP growth is 2.5 to 3%.
Yeah, because money's so cheap, and they could borrow it and fund the futures and fund stock purchases through carry trades against the yen or against the euro. I think this whole thing is very much intertwined, and it's not that I'm knocking it. I just think that that's the setup.
No, I think that's true. And the good growth companies are the ones that we like to invest in when they have periodic troubles. Like Apple. Does Apple really care what U.S. GDP growth is?
No, nope.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. What do you think about Apple? I mean, do you think that with some of the new things that are coming out, like the Playbook, or maybe the competition with the Google tablets that they're and the Samsung Galaxy, that there's any problem there at all? I mean, it seems like the go-to place.
I'm a little worried about Apple for the first time. And I'll tell you why. I think the iPad 2. I have an iPad 1, and I think the iPad 2 was a substandard upgrade. it really didn't offer much more than the iPad 1 did. Slightly better speed, but they put two cameras on there, which are junk. You know, the very old technology. And the size of the thing is a little, you know, it's a little bit smaller, a little bit thinner.
Right.
But it's not really innovative enough to confront the challenges that it faces from its competitors.
Mm-hmm.
The competitor, and I think that they may undershoot their projections for the iPad 2.
Wow.
Which I think could be big trouble for the company because of expectations. You know, drive stock prices.
Yeah.
The one thing that they have going for them is that their competition isn't that hot, you know. Or either you look at if people are very excited about their Research in Motion device, the new playbook. It's coming out theoretically next month. You know, as far as I can tell, there has not been a production. You know, nobody's gotten a hold of an actual production playbook.
Right.
It's all been sort of one of these smoke and mirrors, convention style. Devices in which everybody knows are juiced up beyond what production companies are able to provide. And the other thing is that, you know, it's a very, these tablets are pretty hard to produce. They have incredible displays. They have, you know, very difficult, lots of complex electronics behind them. These touch screens are very notoriously difficult to produce. Until these companies, the competitors to Apple are able to actually produce them, you know, on a million run rate basis, like Apple does, at the price that Apple does. I am not too worried about the competition.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, I mean, you look at people are excited. As I say, people are excited about the RIM device, but you know, ask people about their RIM software, their BlackBerry software, and you know, people like their BlackBerries because it was the first, you know, smartphone that they had that could type on.
Right.
Every attempt by Research in Motion to come up with a successful competitor to the iPhone has failed miserably.
No kidding.
And now they're suddenly going to get it all right.
Yeah.
And be able to produce it right off the bat.
I think not.
Really?
Yeah. No. I think people don't like their BlackBerry. I think they tolerate it. By the way, I think they're used to it, and it's like, you know, you don't want to change. And I think there's some people that have a problem with touchscreens anyway. By the way, those people that have touchscreen problems are going to have touchscreen problems with their BlackBerry Playbook anyway. So, you know, what are you going to do about that?
Nobody really thought that Apple could produce a successful iPod back in 2001 because they had done such a lousy job of producing Macs, you know, new Macs on schedule and successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when the iPhone first came out, there was a lot of skepticism that Apple could come out with a successful iPhone, successful device, and they proved everybody wrong. So, you know, it is possible for RIM to come out with a good device. I'm just a little skeptical until they actually do.
Yeah, I hear you. So let's talk about some sector issues and worldwide issues. I know that you do a lot of worldwide.
Can I back up 1 second?
You can if you want. If you want.
Samsung, on the other hand, I think does produce very nice devices, and I've heard really good things about the Galaxy tablet.
Yeah, the Galaxy, which is run by the Google. I've heard really good. As a matter of fact, I think I played with one actually, and I did like it. And they have a phone too that's pretty cool. So
I'll tell you though, you know, when you compare them side by side.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're in a store and you're comparing the iPad and the Samsung device and mm-hmm. some of the other Android devices that have come out,
mm-hmm.
I think that's on a side-by-side comparison, almost everyone will choose the iPad.
Yeah, I think it is a
superior device.
No question.
There's just certain things that you know that Apple gets right in terms of software and human software interaction
yeah.
that other companies have not been able to manage.
I hear you. So one of the things I know that you do that is you have a global outlook. In other words, you look out in the world and you say, okay, hey, I like, you know, Indonesia, Turkey, or I like Mexico, or whatever it may be. Where in the world do you think is going to be a reasonable place to look? You know, we take like India, great opportunity, but the inflation's killing them. Their markets got crushed recently. You look at Brazil, the same
That's
situation.
That's a great question. Great question. You know, right now, I've just in the past 3 weeks or months, started to get interested in the emerging markets. You know, they came down quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Then they stabilized. And as the United States and Europe were kind of going down and sort of moving sideways in the last month, the emerging markets have actually started to come back. Very reminiscent of what we saw in June. last year when the Western markets were going down and the emerging markets were kind of stabilizing and moving up. And I see a lot of great opportunities right now. Indonesia looks great.
Mm-hmm.
India looks to me like it's starting to turn the corner. And those companies can be fantastic when they turn. I'm talking about like Tata Motors, TTM is the symbol,
mm-hmm.
or the bank symbol IBM.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's I don't know. I can't pronounce the name. It's ICIC.
Yeah, ICIC bank, right? Exactly. And the, so Indonesia, okay.
Now and also on the technology side in India, you know, Infosys,
mm-hmm.
INFY has been crushed, but looks like it's about to come back. And Cognizant, which is a U.S. company, but it's considered to by most people to be Indian because that's where their headquarters is. I mean, that's one of their one of their headquarters is. Is at a new high, and it looks fantastic.
Yeah, CTSH. That's a good stock.
CTSH.
Yep. So where else? I mean, what about Europe? I mean, is there any emerging Europe at all or anything there, or are you just staying away from that area?
I really like Germany. You know, Germany is a fantastic play on China.
Mm-hmm. For the output, yeah.
Because, you know, what China needs the most from the West is high-end factory electronics.
Mm-hmm.
And the German companies supply that to the Chinese at a much greater rate than any other region in the world, including Japan and the United States. So I think that the German mid-caps and small-caps in particular, but also the German large-caps are going to be good to own over the next few years. The way I invest in it is through the iShares, EWG, mm-hmm. iShares Germany, or also there's a nice closed-end fund called New Germany Fund, and that symbol is GF.
GF.
The advantage of the New Germany Fund is that it owns small caps and mid caps.
Interesting. Okay. And then what about all the things that are going on in the Middle East? I mean, is there anything there, whether it's Israel, whether it's, I mean, Egypt, you know, I don't even know what to say about that. But you know, I guess we have to stay away from Egypt, a market that's closed for a month and a half, probably something we don't want to be involved in, right? at any rate.
Yeah, it's really true. And if you know, it's interesting you should say that because a lot of diversified bond funds around in the United States had Egyptian bonds and probably some Libyan bonds as well, and they haven't been able to price.
Right.
So, that's kind of a problem, but you know, the main theater in the Middle East, obviously, is Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And the big question we have is, you know, if a democracy movement were to emerge there, how far would the Saudi government go in knocking it down? And I think we've started to see that there is a nascent movement for the Saudi government. Asking the Saudi government to share power, to create more jobs, to share more of the country's wealth with the poor, of which there are lots in Saudi Arabia, but they haven't gotten very far. You know, they scheduled a day of rage a couple of weeks ago, and that it didn't work out too well because it was put down by both the dissidents. Most of the major dissidents didn't participate.
Well, they would have got rubber bullets in their face and tear gas. And then why would they do it anyway? Because the government came in with $30 billion of bribe money right after the fact to shut the whole thing down. So it was just a...
Well, exactly.
What a farce.
It is a farce, but you could almost say that the protesters or the dissidents got part of what they wanted.
Yeah, they got what they wanted. They got shut-up money is what they got. They wanted not only sharing of the wealth, but they also wanted to have the opportunity to have a, I don't want to call it democratic, but at least a part in the government process. And the sad thing is that it's clearly knowledge now that the Saudi government has been holding out dramatic amounts of money from their people. And only upon not only request, but upon uprising do they release any of it. That's just disgusting.
Yeah, I'm calling them. I don't know what to say. You know, it's the way they do things over there. I mean,
I hear you. I'm with you. It's like anything else. You know,
we have a pretty big income disparity in the United States too. In fact, I think strangely enough, I think the income disparity in the United States is larger than in Saudi Arabia.
Well, we should protest and then see who sends us money. You know?
I think they did that. Didn't the government change the tax rates in December?
Yeah, well, good point. Good point. So what else around the world? So do you have a thought process on what's going to end up being with the municipality issue that's going on around the country? I mean, there's a lot of talk from Meredith Whitney and a few others. Oh, problem. Of course, Bernanke and the gang, no problem. But do you have any kind of thought on this?
With all the troubles that cities have had over the past, 50 years, ranging from Orange County into Fairfield, California, Alabama, Illinois, Wisconsin, do you know how many municipal bonds have actually gone bust?
I'm sure this number is ridiculously low, if not zero.
It's zero.
Yeah, zero. Mm-hmm.
So, cities have to, cities and states are not like the federal government. They have to meet their budgets. So ultimately, they'll find a way to do it. And
Didn't they try that in Wisconsin? What happened there?
The governor's going to win.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean,
In Illinois, it's austerity times. It's tough for them, but they're going to bring in that state under budget. California, obviously, in big trouble. But the bonds are the munis got hit recently, but they're not crashing or anything. I think that the feeling is that somewhere or another, these city and state governments are going to cut spending to the extent that they can renew their ability to float bonds.
Yeah, and you know what? It's like Portugal. Listen, the guy Socrates, whatever his name is, the prime minister resigned. And you would think, that's going to be a problem. But meanwhile, the euro just goes right up because the whole idea is, well, that's great. Because of that, it's going to force not only no austerity in the region and no tax hikes in Portugal, but we're going to get $100 billion that's below market rates. And everybody's like, yeah, that's great. That's terrific. This is the world we're living in. And the fact is that you have a couple choices, I think. And tell me how you feel about this. You can either bitch and moan about all the stuff that's going on, that it's not fair, or it's going to be ruin the world in the future. It's going to cause inflation. It's going to be bankruptcy in the future. It's passing the stuff on to our kids, whatever you want to say. Or you could realize that it's not going to change, unfortunately, or fortunately, and just play along right now.
Yeah, I think I read a lot of financial history, as you know, and my studies have shown me that virtually every era thinks that their era is the worst.
right. Our kids aren't going to have as much as we had.
Exactly. And you look at, you read about what the Americans were saying in the 1860s during the Civil War. When the idea of a greenback or paper money that was not backed by gold was developed, and people thought that was the end of life on Earth.
Right.
And you read about the 1890s and the early 1900s. Cross of Gold speech by Jennings. People were very concerned about the debasement of the currency then. And that was back when the bread was 55 cents, and now it's $3.50. What's the difference? Still same loaf of bread. Corn really hasn't gone up very much. Mm-hmm. It's just currency debasement. Has it ruined the country? Well, you could say maybe it has, maybe it hasn't. But our standards of living are a lot higher now than they were in 1900.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's all a perspective of where you're from, where you live. And that's why I wonder about the Japanese situation, how they can be profitable if they have, basically to cut their costs by 30%. Or how can they teach the rest of us to be more efficient and then create a much better deal for all of us? I don't know. Just a thought. All right. Any parting words before we end this up? I mean, we know that, again, John Markman writing for Market Watch, and he writes the Strategic Advantage newsletter, amongst others, that you can get, and I'll put links on the site so you can grab the information on how to get yourself a copy of this, because it's some great stuff and very direct. Anything else that's kind of hitting you as really great or really awful or something in between?
Yeah, I think we're coming into the end of the quarter, which means that the pre-announcement period for next quarter is almost upon us. And I think we're going to hear a lot of the dog ate my homework excuses about Japan.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the real question is we're going to have to really pay attention to how investors treat those excuses. Are they going to say, oh, yeah, the dog did eat your homework, no problem. You can turn it in again tomorrow. You know,
right?
If investors start to give companies a free pass on that excuse, then I think that the next quarter can be a pretty good quarter for U.S. stocks, because they've been beaten up pretty much in this towards the end of this quarter.
Yeah, well, they're beaten up and then they're taken back. I mean, they moved pretty wildly. I'll tell you something though. I think that they already got a pass on the weather excuse. Okay, let's be honest. There was a lot of weather going on back last quarter.
It's exactly the same thing as when retailers say, "Oh yeah, weather was bad, and that's why my sales are down."
Right.
Well, you know, you have to pay attention. It's not the excuse; it's the way the market reacts to the excuse.
Right.
So, if the market starts to give people a pass on the weather excuse, then you got to go along with it. And the same thing is going to happen when we start to hear about companies' Japan excuse. So for that, start to look at Texas Instruments. Texas Instruments is probably the first company to come out and say, we have a problem here. And they did trade it down, but now it's coming back. So I'm thinking that maybe the investors will give companies a pass.
Yeah, they did the same thing with Adobe. Adobe, they took down, 7%. The next day it's up 5.5% or 4.5%. The reality is that I say it's all buy in the dip. It's all, if it's down, buy. If it's up, sell it. And right now there's really no way to judge.
Step back a second, you know, it's the Fed. You know?
Yes, correct. I'll give you that.
Just remember, the Fed's on your side.
Mm-hmm.
Don't fight the Fed. That's number one. Number two is the Fed's on your side. Don't fight the Fed. And I think you can figure out what number three is.
Yeah, I'm going to work on that.
And number four is core inflation is low.
Yeah.
The best environment for U.S. stocks is when inflation is low, everything else being equal. Because it gives PEs an opportunity to rise.
By the way, I also like to add that it's also good when you have a high unemployment rate, because the old high unemployment rate was problematic when we were just more of a domestic demand. But now that you have a global demand, high unemployment could mean a higher level of efficiency in a company and a greater degree of margin expansion.
Yeah, look at Caterpillar.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Look at Rockwell Automation.
I love that company. What a great company.
Look at 3M. You know, look at United
mm-hmm.
Technologies.
Yep.
You know, these companies are succeeding on a worldwide basis. They're not, you know, they're not giving any dog ate my homework type of excuses. And you know, there are, and even old bedraggled Pfizer is coming back.
Yeah, some of those guys got beaten up pretty good, didn't they? Like Abbott, Pfizer, Bristol. I mean, these guys got beaten up for a while, and now they're. You know, I think that, again, I think it's because they were overdone, and finally somebody said, okay, eventually things going to be okay. I think we got beyond the idea that we're going to have another meltdown immediately due to the financials, again, because of your 1, 2, and 3 rationale. And I think that there's a lot more support in all of that. And even the companies that aren't allowed to pay dividends don't even get slammed because they're, you know, realizing how the Fed is so liberal. You know, I just think that right now there's a lot of complacency, and that's not necessarily bad, but complacency when we see that we have nuclear radiation leakage, we have civil war uprisings, we have countries on the verge of problems in the European area, and all things that we have over here with high unemployment, and the market is allowed to, you know, just kind of do its thing and stay in a very tight range. I just think there's complacency. That doesn't have to be bad. I'm just saying what it is.
Yeah, I don't see a high level of complacency. You know, I think there was high level of complacency earlier in the year. I think complacency was eradicated by the kind of the things you just mentioned. You know, the Japanese issue, the plunging stocks, volatility went up. And I think right now you kind of see the right amount of anxiety. People aren't quite sure. There's a lot of confusion. To me, that's a pretty good environment because you have the Fed pumping, low inflation, and sentiment is lousy. That's usually a pretty good formula for stocks.
Yep, I hear you. Climbing the wall of worry, they say, and with the Fed again, you know, behind.
The big trouble I see is number one, the banks are in pretty bad shape. You know, let's face it. You know, the Goldman Sachs and the J.P. Morgans, they're the ones who are really holding the Dow back from being as successful as it could be.
Right.
Drug makers with their generic problem, the lack of stuff in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
That's another big problem for the major indexes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you kind of draw back from the big indexes, you know, forget about the Dow and the S&P for a minute, and look at the mid caps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where there's not as much overweight to the big banks and the big drug companies. I think you see a lot more success. And I my strongest recommendation, my largest position by far in my newsletters is mid-cap growth companies.
Yep.
And if you want to just focus on those, you can buy the iShares symbol IJK.
Yep. There's a couple of mutual funds out there that we like also in the mid-cap area. There's an Aston and a few others. We use that for our global allocations. But they I think, I'll tell you something, if anybody, any of my listeners want to consider looking back at the history of the last few years, the mid-caps, boy, they have been fantastic. They're kind of, as I see it, they're the small caps that are, it's kind of like a fine wine that's almost ready to get to the point of just a beautiful drinkability. But, you know, versus a, you know, a Beaujolais Nouveau, you know, you have the small caps may be small, very volatile, questionable. The mid caps are kind of like, you know, they're in the sweet spot. They're not too large. People still haven't noticed all of them. There's still a great opportunity. They're still very nimble. You know, I think that's
the way I look
cool.
at it is that in order to advance from being a $1 billion small cap to a, you know, $10 billion large cap, you've got to go through the mid caps.
Right.
And
exactly.
that's a $10 billion zone.
Yeah.
And the growthier companies are the ones that I think have the most success. Are the ones that are the most likely to move from being a successful small cap company to being a large cap company.
Yep.
And that sweet zone, in my opinion, is, you know, when I look back over history, you know, I see that even there are some periods in some years, some calendar years, in the last 20 years, when large caps do well, and there's some years when small caps do well. And it can be hard to figure out in advance which those years are going to be,
right,
so that small or the large.
Right.
But in both circumstances, the mid caps do almost as good as the big caps, and they do almost as well as the small caps.
Right.
And then the small cap growth segment tends to do very well in all those environments.
Yep,
so,
I hear.
So I think that it's a good place to look. And just as an example, you know, the example of a small cap company that got to be large and passed through the mid-cap growth would be Netflix.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of years ago, Netflix was basically, who's that? And then they started growing like crazy, and they became a successful mid-cap. And in December, they were put into the S&P 500.
Yeah, so that was a quick move. That was a quick move.
It was. But it's emblematic of what happens in the amongst the mid-cap growth companies.
Yeah, I hear
they, you. They are fast-tracking.
Yep.
I'll make one last comment, and that is, I'm going to make my a first to the world announcement here on your show.
A first? Come on, really? I don't even know what it is. I'm not kidding, I don't even know what this is. I'm freaking out. Go ahead, go.
I'm starting a new features newsletter.
Really? What does that mean? What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a newsletter that's going to be focused on timing S&P 500 and bond features.
Wow.
And it's going to launch in the middle of next week, and it is called Gemini 252.
Wow, it sounds like a spacecraft or maybe some kind of experimental drug, but that's cool.
Thank you. I'm glad it sounds futuristic.
Well, that's good. So we'll get everybody looking at that. Will you explain to people how to actually buy futures?
Yes. All the materials that are surrounding the company, the new letter, we'll explain to you how to open up a futures account and how to trade the futures effectively.
Wow.
This is not a day trading newsletter.
Right.
It's going to be strictly focused on the best opportunities to buy both of those contracts, usually on weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, market's going down. This system has a very good and systematic way of understanding when it's down enough to buy,
mm-hmm,
and then it has a very systematic way of knowing when to sell.
Cool.
And as an example, back in the Japanese crisis of a few weeks ago, I think we managed to pull off a big win by being long the S&P.
Yeah.
Being long the S&P while it was going down,
mm-hmm,
and making a small fortune.
Wow. Nice.
Because we were buying the pressure lows.
Mm-hmm.
And then selling on the rebound.
Wow, that's good. Very nice. Very nice.
So, look at that.
The futures newsletter.
Gemini 252.
Gemini 252. It's a planet just out of distance to see, but It's the futuristic view from John Markman on futures. John Markman, thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll get everybody checking out your new newsletter as well as Strategic Advantage and all your wonderful writings and your visionary and your visionary illuminations.
Thank you.
How's that?
Great to talk to you, Andrew.
All right, I'll see you soon.
Always fun to talk to you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, that's going to wrap it up for this week. And basically, any questions you have, just send it to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I hope you enjoyed this show. It was kind of fun talking about the situation in Japan. We'll just have to see what's going to play out in the next few weeks here and see how much information we can actually get, I guess, from the Japanese government that we could believe in. Because so far, that's questionable at best, right? All right, thanks for joining me again. And we'll see you soon on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.